probably because of my operational background, my approach to being an entrepreneur is really to first and foremost be a maker. That you build and learn and iterate on your ideas and, you know, focusing on the toughest problems first. And I'd say, you know, at Virtual Incision, we've got a little bit of an MIT approach, which probably isn't surprising given Shane's background. And I also had a son attend undergrad there. But it's, you know, mente, manus, mantras. It's mind and hand. It's a hands-on practitioner's approach. So even Shane would tell you, rather than measuring twice, cut once, you should measure once and cut twice.
Welcome to MedSider Radio, where you can learn from proven medtech and healthcare thought leaders through uncut and unedited interviews. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedSider, I sat down with John Murphy, the co-founder and CEO of Virtual Incision. With a background in life sciences, aerospace, private equity, and venture capital, John co-founded Virtual Incision in 2006. The company makes miniature portable robots that can be used to perform specific operations. The first iteration is designed for colon resections with new variations planned for the future. Here are a few of the things that we discussed in this interview. First, more funding is coming into the medical device space, but it's still tricky bringing investors on board in early rounds. Consider approaching regional funds, which might be more inclined than nationally known firms to support local companies. Second, design a regulatory pathway that complements your R&D strategy. If you're working on brand new technology and plan to create further iterations, consider applying for a de novo classification. This can serve as a foundation for the 510K notifications you file for later variations. Third, consider a dual track approach to exiting, preparing for an IPO and for a potential acquisition at the same time. You'll have to hit a lot of milestones, but it's worth the effort. Okay, so before we jump into the discussion, I want to mention a few things. First, this episode is brought to you by Qualio, one of the most trusted providers of quality management software for life science companies. That's Qualio with a Q, Q-U-A-L-I-O. Over 300 leading worldwide therapeutics, medical device, and clinical research organizations leverage Qualio's cloud-based quality management system software to unite their teams, processes, and data. With Qualio, life science companies can safely scale and swiftly bridge product development and quality management while also seamlessly addressing complex compliance and regulatory approvals. To see Qualio in action, visit MedSiderRadio.com/Qualio. Again, that's MedSiderRadio.com/Qualio. For MedSider listeners, Qualio put together a free guide on how to transition your company to a paperless eQMS. It's available at no cost by visiting MedSiderRadio.com/paperless. Again, that's MedSiderRadio.com/paperless. So there's two links for you to remember. See Qualio in action by visiting MedSiderRadio.com/Qualio and get Qualio's free guide on how to transition to a paperless eQMS by visiting MedSiderRadio.com/paperless. Okay, second, if you're into learning from proven medtech leaders and want to know when the new content and interviews go live, head over to MedSider.com and sign up for our free newsletter. You'll get access to gated articles and lots of other interesting healthcare content. If you want even more inside info from medtech experts, think about a MedSider premium membership. We talk to experienced healthcare leaders about the nuts and bolts of running a business and bringing products to market. This is your place for valuable knowledge on specific topics like seed funding, prototyping, insurance reimbursement, and positioning a medtech startup for an exit. In addition to the entire back catalog of MedSider interviews over the past decade, premium members get exclusive Ask Me Anything interviews and masterclasses with some of the world's most successful medtech founders and executives. Since making the premium memberships available, I've been pleasantly surprised at how many people have signed up. So if you're interested, go to MedSider.com to learn more. All right, without further ado, let's get to the interview. John, welcome to MedSider.
Scott, thanks for having me. It's nice to spend some time with you.
And I know we're calling from the same side of the country here in California. You're just in the northern part. I'm in the southern part. Yeah, looking forward to the conversation. It should be a fun one.
Indeed.
So with that said, let's. I provided a kind of an overview of your background, a very high level overview of your background, kind of at the outset of this interview. But I always love to start here first. I'd love to hear kind of your elevator pitch on your professional background, leading up to kind of your current roles at not only Virtual Incision, but also, you know, Tri-Valley Ventures and kind of what you've done there.
Yeah, great. Scott, I'm a London native. I grew up in a place called Shepherd's Bush in West London up until I was about 22 years old. And I did a computer science undergrad in London, and then did an electrical engineering and computer science master's over in Chicago, because I had fallen in love with the U.S. following about a six-week Greyhound bus tour around the perimeter of the country with some friends. And so it wasn't much later that I arrived in O'Hare with just a couple of bags and in hand, and had never really looked back. So, you know, my early career was career work was in software engineering and systems analysis. But then I did an MBA in international finance, and that set me off on a great global career where I really worked on kind of deep tech embedded systems in sectors like aerospace and life sciences. You know, more in corporate world. And then I did a couple of middle market private equity CEO roles before landing at Virtual Incision. And like, as you mentioned, we're in Northern California here. I've lived in Pleasanton with my wonderful wife, Liz, for about the last 20 years. We're in the East Bay of San Francisco, and lucky to have raised four terrific children. And, you know, they're off doing cool things now. And it really is, it's because I've been here for such a long time. I think this is a really spectacular startup ecosystem here in the Tri-Valley around this area. And so I joined Tri-Valley Ventures with a couple of co-founders there to fund a number of startups in the East Bay. I think we're the first venture fund in the East Bay. So I've gone full entrepreneur and investor on these things, Scott.
Yes, sitting on both sides of the table, and I know we're gonna spend most of our time talking about sort of the journey at Virtual Incision. But can you touch real quickly on Tri-Valley? Where do you, you know, where at what stage do you typically invest in companies? Are there certain categories that you typically like to invest in? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, it's all about early stage seed investment and Series A mainly, and it's for all companies only located in the Tri-Valley, which is, you know, Dublin, Pleasanton, Livermore, a little bit up the Bay Area here. So, you know, we've got a lot of SaaS. This is maybe one of the homes of enterprise SaaS, from Viva to all sorts around here, but also a lot of deep techers tied to, you know, Lawrence Livermore National Labs. And so we see device, we see AI, we see software as a service. So Fund One was just a small little fund that we invested in, you know, a dozen companies or so. We're just off on closed out, again, a microcap fund two to do the same for over the next few years. So, you know, bio, med device, SaaS, those types of things we're seeing. So it's really exciting.
Okay. So all early stage, all pretty early stage,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. The fun parts, in my opinion, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, this should be good, because I'm interested to get kind of your take on a few different talking points, especially considering you've got experience, right? Kind of, you know, operationally running companies, as well as investing in the early stages. So, with that said, let's transition to Virtual Incision. Can you take us back in time? I think your LinkedIn profile says you technically started at Virtual Incision back in 2012. I'm not sure if that was really, if things started earlier than that or maybe a little bit later, but talk to us a little bit about kind of how the idea for the Mira platform kind of came to be.
Yeah, you know, Scott, I think the founding story of Virtual Incision is pretty cool, because somewhat surprisingly, the University of Nebraska Med Center in Omaha acquired Da Vinci serial number 8 or something like that. And they recruited in my co-founder and chief medical officer colleague, Dmitry Alinikov, to come in and run UNMC's, and minimally invasive surgery and their fledgling robotics program. So Dmitry, he's a chief of surgery, he's an advanced laparoscopic surgeon, a luminary surgeon in many ways. And so he started thinking about how you could use little robots on the inside instead of big robots on the outside for things in general surgery. And about that same time, he met my co-founder and chief technology officer colleague, Shane Farriter. And Shane was just returning from three stints at different NASA sites. He's a Mars rover guy. He's an MIT PhD roboticist, maybe a top 10 roboticist on the planet. Who knows? A good Nebraska guy heading back to Lincoln to be a professor of mechanical engineering at UNL. So again, they started this in the early 2000s, formed the company in 2006. And then I met them at JP Morgan, I think it was January 2011. And I was just gripped by this crazy idea of mini robots for general surgery, because I had been a supplier to Intuitive Surgical and was totally amazed about their pioneering work and the incredible work they've done over the last couple of decades here for robotics in the OR. But this idea, you know, of mini robots that you could deploy anywhere in any OR in any setting really grabbed me. And so here we are with the Mira platform today.
Got it. That's cool. I'm originally from the Midwest, so very familiar with Omaha and Lincoln, which is, you know, for anyone familiar, is about 45 minutes to an hour west of Omaha. So definitely cool institution. A lot of great minds there. So, and I would encourage everyone, we'll link to the website in the show notes for this interview, but go to Virtual Incision and check out some of this technology. It's really cool, especially if you're kind of, you know, following the robotic scene. Tons of activity. It seems like there, you know, every week there's a new robotics company that I hear about. So before we kind of get too far into learning kind of, you know, lessons kind of learned that you've gleaned along the way, along your career, and especially with respect to Virtual Incision, John, tell us a little bit more about how your technology, the Mira platform, is different, right? And maybe don't go too far into the weeds, but like, how is it different than, you know, a lot of the other robotics companies that are in development now?
Yeah, so I think we're unique in that we've got a 2-pound robot versus a 2,000-pound robot. We definitely see this type of platform complementary to the mainframes of today, where you might have a mainframe robot in one or two rooms. But then I think we've been thinking about, what about the other 80% of ORs? We've been thinking about, you know, academic centers, yes, and high volume centers, but what about community hospitals and rural settings and the ambulatory surgery center and OUS? What kind of solutions are really going to, you know, be plausible in those locations? And so we focused on a device that, you know, can be mobile and used in any OR. It's a foundational, beautiful technology, robotics excellence, as you'd expect, you know, on some of these, you know, the existing platforms. But again, it's a small package. It can be set up in any OR in, you know, under 10 minutes. There's no draping. It's easy quadrant changes for multi-quadrant surgery. So we're really taking a specialized approach to a robot for a specific procedure instead of a generalized robot. So our first indication is colon resection, which is probably the marquee surgery in general surgery. And then we'll add a family of these mini robots for things like hernia repair and gallbladder removal, and then on to hysterectomy or gastrectomy and those types of things. So yeah, I think take a look at the website. You get a little idea of what we're up to.
Got it. And I'm presuming, so you mentioned that Shane and Dimitri kind of initially started the company, did you say, back in the, was it the early, mid-2000s, roughly?
Yeah, mid-2000s, 2006 was the genesis, yeah.
And then, so when you first met them, you know, at JP Morgan, kind of in that 2011 timeframe, how much progress had they made on the technology at that point in time?
Yeah, you know, it was more the idea. This has been a miniaturization journey, really, over the last decade, tell the truth, Scott. And our current robot, we kind of, you know, from the prototype side, is what we call Alpha 5. And that's what we're going through the FDA IDE and de novo process with now. But, you know, back then it was Alpha 1. We started with a robot that you had to assemble inside the abdomen, in the insufflated abdomen. And then Alpha 2, we were able to get one arm in at a time and, you know, with the two arms. And then Alpha 3 was a breakthrough because it was the first wholly contained robot with its whole, you know, a separate but integrated flex tip camera. And there we went to OUS first in man in Paraguay on that device. We learned a lot in those on that small clinical study. And that spawned Alpha 4 and Alpha 5 development. So, you know, along the way, lots and lots of preclinical labs. We probably built 40 or 50 or 60 different types of robots and devices. And so that's been the journey to get to this stage.
Got it. That's cool. And the website that I mentioned earlier, virtualincision.com, if you actually go to the site, you've got really cool images of these different Alpha products, Alpha 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So it's kind of cool to see that. Yeah. That progress. Well, with that said, John, let's talk a little bit about funding, right? These early prototypes, right? And that early journey for a startup like Virtual Incision, especially considering, you know, you sit on, like I said before, you sit on the opposite side of the table as an investor too. So when you think about kind of that, those dynamics, you know, operationally running a startup versus investing in them. For other entrepreneurs that are in the same space, right? They need to raise their next round of capital. And let's maybe frame it up as maybe early stage capital, seed, maybe series A or B, not late stage. You know, yeah. is there a couple like really key kind of things that you think those med tech or health tech entrepreneurs really need to understand about this process?
Yeah, Scott, you know, I'd start off by saying that I think all rounds are difficult, and particularly in device, and you know this, we've really kind of just emerging from a little bit of a nuclear winter, really, in device funding. And, you know, it was the same for biotech before that, and they've emerged beautifully. And, you know, health IT has been on a great run, and now device, I think, is starting to get better too. It's considered more part of the solution with novel treatments and cost control, and there's data with everything too now. So it's all changing over that last decade. And so, you know, the things I think about is, you know, most of the traditional VCs, if they exist now in device, right, or later, are going much, much later stage, at least a Series C and beyond approvals and things like this. So it's really tricky to line up your Series A's and your B efforts. So I like to keep the series somewhat pure if you can, you know, friends and family and, you know, and seed to get things going. And then if you can find some early stage capital, people who understand this stage, maybe regional capital, that's certainly, we got our early Series A was done in Sioux Falls, just 3 hours from Lincoln, for example. And that can help you, you know, build your early concepts and prototyping. And then Series B, keeping it, again, traditional and focused, where you're really moving then on to advanced prototypes and then your early clin reg hurdles. And then Series C, again, is regulatory approval and early commercialization. So I think if you can keep it some discipline by funding stage, I think that's good. But the most important thing, I think, for the entrepreneur in all these cases, whether you're in tech or med tech or wherever, is to just have this compelling mission to guide you through. These journeys are usually 7 or 10 years. They're long, so you really got to believe in what you're doing. And then we're lucky in device to have this kind of great noble purpose to our endeavors, but there's also no hiding and imposters don't survive. So it's just absolutely essential to focus on the clinical solution and the clinical workflow and building great gear and solutions around that. So that's a few of the things that, you know, I think about when looking at building these companies.
Those are good thoughts. And if I maybe this is a fair summary of kind of your answer would be thinking about like making sure that you're strategic in you in thinking about your capital raises and aligning with, you know, classic stages or inflection points of the company, right? From prototyping to early stage kind of development to reg and then clinical, maybe in the later stage rounds. And then secondarily, what I heard from you is there's gotta be sort of an underlying kind of, you know, driving passion or mission behind the company, because these are long journeys, right? This is not typically a 1, 2, 3 year turnaround. It's a, you know, it's 7, 10, 15 years, you know, in the making. So there's gotta be some meat on the bone from that standpoint is what I kind of understand from you.
Yeah, exactly. Great paraphrase. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a conversation I recently had with Holly Rockweiler, who runs Medora. I think they used to be based in Northern California there, but she's in Portland now. We talked about the very same thing, that how crucial it was for her in their journey as a company, that she was actually very passionate about the clinical problems that she was trying to solve. You know, and she mentioned the very same thing that you did, is like that absolutely was critical, right? And kind of pushing through all of these hurdles, you know, that you need to cross, going from one stage to the next. And so with that said, John, let's transition to maybe the opposite end of the spectrum, right? Where you've got, you know, maybe the company's, you know, well funded, you've closed on your Series C or your D, you're hitting your milestones and thinking about an exit, a liquidity event, whether it's an acquisition, which is probably the more likely scenario, or an IPO. Can you talk to us a little bit more about like your general approach to that? I don't want to sound too vague, but like maybe what are some of the key things that, you know, other startup founders should be thinking about when it comes time to a potential exit event?
Yeah, you know, first I think an important mindset is that you run your company as if you're going to own it forever. So that kind of just sets a baseline. But then I say, you know, following a high quality dual track to either an M&A or an IPO is a good way to go. So some might say there's even a tri-track approach these days, including, you know, the SPAC IPO and things like that. But I think a solid dual track approach is still the way to go, particularly, you know, in device. Because, you know, pre-revenue or small cap public companies, they're extremely tough. So again, keep it more traditional, you know, post-approval, solid revenue CAGR, healthy R&D pipeline, all that if you're going to position for the public market exit. And then on strategics, I think pre-approval M&A is still very rare. So unless you're in really sizzling hot segments like surgical robotics, potentially, or something like that. So you really just have to complete your regulatory milestones. And you know, there's a number of these usual prerequisite milestones around clinical value prop, your IP, your quality management system, your financials and financial audits, and your HR house being in order. So there's a ton of work to put some teeth into your dual track, whether you're IPO or a strategic M&A. And then for strategics, I think you just got to keep them up to speed with your progress. M&A is definitely the lifeblood, you know, it's the innovation engine for a strategic. So they want to talk to you and see your progress, and that can lead to good things. So that's how I think about our situation for dual track M&A or IPO. And then PE is a whole different bird altogether. It's a little bit different type of company. Obviously, you're leveraging EBITDA. You're really executing around operational efficiencies or growth vein and these types of things. So that's different. That's for more long-time entrepreneurs, I think, that maybe can get some dilution, get some payback, you know, in their company and then go on to the next stage. But that's a little bit of a different situation again.
Got it. I love the kind of the thought process or the kind of the mindset of that sort of that dual or even like trifecta sort of a approach, right? With M&A, you know, an IPO or a SPAC. And so I love kind of the framework. But when it comes to strategics, you know, considering that's probably the most likely outcome for most med tech startups or healthcare startups in general. Yeah. How often, like, do you have kind of a preferred approach for how you typically like to keep strategics involved, kind of along the journey? Is it once a year you're reaching out? Is it very intentional, or is it you're trying to catch up at various conferences, presuming we actually get back to those at some point in person, right? Conferences? But yeah, what's your general kind of perspective on how to run those conversations or keep strategics up to date?
Yeah, I think first you got to understand who you really want to kind of work with. And so maybe there's a handful of folks you want to keep up to speed as likely M&A exits. And then you're right, you're just building a rhythm, and each firm may be a little bit different. One might be a quarterly update, you know, with the BD team, you know, spearheading. Or others might be, you know, you're at Sage's conference and you want to do a private tech demo with them, and or share your, you know, your approach on the clinical side or feedback and things like that. So I think you're looking for a regular rhythm. It could be quarterly. It could be, you know, depending where you are, maybe a 6 months update could be good because you've hit certain milestones or accomplished certain things. But, you know, get to know the teams early and who you're dealing with and what their interests are, and kind of get on that kind of rhythm, I think is how I think about it.
Got it. So maybe the tactics will change, right, based on kind of who you're targeting, but just making sure there's some sort of activity, right, regardless of whether it's a demo, maybe it's just a simple email with a progress update or something like that, making sure that you are being, you know, fairly consistent about, you know, with your kind of your target audience, so to speak.
I think that's right.
Well, good stuff. Let's talk a little bit. Let's go back to kind of that conversation around, you know, ideation and concepting and talking a little bit more about like your alpha and beta prototypes. You know, of course, with you know, really innovative technology, you know, like you're working on at Virtual Incision, you know, those are extensive projects, right? It's not like you're iterating on concepts month over month. But when you think about this topic in general, right, building out your alpha and beta prototypes, those very early stages, what do you see as like the most common mistakes to avoid, you know, that, you know, for other, you know, engineers or physicians that are working on medical technology?
Yeah, you know, I think that probably because of my operational background, my approach to being an entrepreneur is really to first and foremost be a maker. That you build and learn and iterate on your ideas and, you know, focusing on the toughest problems first. And I'd say, you know, at Virtual Incision, we've got a little bit of an MIT approach, which probably isn't surprising given Shane's background. And I also had a son attend undergrad there. But it's, you know, mente manus mantras. It's mind and hand. It's a hands-on practitioner's approach. So even Shane would tell you, rather than measuring twice, cut once, you should measure once and cut twice. So it's this kind of mode of working. In fact, every desk at Virtual Incision is handmade by Shane. It's as a reminder every day that, hey, we're makers, we're doers, we're problem solvers. So I just want you know, you've got to have that orientation, I think, to solve these clinical solutions. And then, you know, in surgical robotics, it's very cross-functional, a very challenging field. So I think you need this kind of, you know, maker approach to certainly hit Dimitri's clinical visions and standards and things like that. So I just make sure that's an orientation if you're certainly a device maker. And then the other one, the one startling mistake I pulled out is CEOs pouring on commercial team spending, you know, which is probably the most expensive part of fielding a new device, way too early. So I would emphasize high or even extreme capital efficiency until you have your clinical and your product solution in hand, and just keep building value at each stage so you can make money for your long-term investors. And so just be smart and efficient with your funding. That's kind of the other mindset I think you need to have.
Got it. I love the maker sort of culture, right? That you mentioned. This it reminds me of a chat we were having with I think it was it earlier this week. In fact, we were talking about a device that we're working on as part of a company that we incubated. And I think the question was posed to Brady Hatcher, who runs Switchback Medical, which is a catheter contract manufacturer. You know, so what are the next steps here? He said, well, we've got to get to the benchtop and start making things. You know, arts and crafts here. We've got to like actually build some stuff. I mean, that's the next phase. You know, it's no more CAD files, right? We got to actually put our hands on this stuff and start making things. And so, I love the approach and kind of the what it sounds like. Kind of the cultural emphasis that you put around like making and building versus trying to get things perfect, right? A ready, fire, aim type of approach versus, you know, measuring two or three times and then cutting. Right. I like that analogy you used. Yeah.
Right.
That's great stuff. All right. Moving on. Okay. Let's kind of like follow that sort of general like track for a device company. You've got your alpha and beta builds. You're in the process of kind of looking at your clinical and regulatory strategy and trying to map that out. You mentioned earlier, you know, really trying to optimize around capital efficiency at these various sort of stages and inflection points. But is there anything else that you're thinking about as you begin to kind of plan out that reg and clinical approach?
Yeah, you know, these are big things for a device company, as you know. So on the regulatory front, I think it's really important to maintain a constructive, cooperative, trusting, team approach to the regulator, because really you're pulling these things through approvals together. So that's kind of our mindset around that. And so just at Virtual Incision, our first step is to seek a de novo approval, you know, as a new category of robotics, a next generation mini robots for general surgery. And so that's our linchpin. And then as we're building a family of these mini robots, you know, for specific procedures, we can then use a 510K pathway on our initial device around, you know, follow-on approval. So, you know, for these different indications and different procedures and the like. So having a strategic way, a pragmatic way to step through the process, I think is really smart. And then clinical is even different. You know, a little bit going back to our maker genesis or our approach again is that we did tons of preclinical labs because it's really how you learn and you test and you look at clinical workflows and clinical excellence and clinical performance. So, you know, then again, I describe going into, you know, your OUS first in man. And then now we're in a very important part of our approval is the FDA IDE clinical study in the United States, which we've just started. And these are massive filings. These are 8,000 page submissions for a robotic system like this. But, you know, I think you've got to be strategic in your regulatory and pragmatic as you build things out, certainly in this kind of complex an area. And then your clinical, you know, is leverage your preclinicals to learn and then build carefully and especially through your clinical approaches. So,
yeah. And I guess just a couple follow-up questions, maybe more specific to your clinical approach. You mentioned, I think you did some of the first in man work for Virtual Incision in Paraguay, I believe.
Yes. Right?
So, like starting over, right? Let's say you had to do your first demand, you know, within the next 6 months, would you still kind of approach or would you still be biased towards doing that work outside of the United States versus identifying, you know, some potential, you know, one or two sites here in the US to do the first in human clinical?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think it's changed over time. You know, it used to be CE mark was maybe a good way to go first in Europe and then use data and come back to the FDA in the United States. And we never considered any of those things. It was always about the FDA. They're always really the most important regulatory body, we think, to first to work with to get the full system through. And we had a wonderful connection with a surgeon down in Asuncion. And a surgeon in at Duke University that we were able to really explore our Alpha 3 prototype for our first in man, and we just learned so much around the dexterity of the robot, the range of motion of our camera, you know, all around the size of the robot and these types of things. So it was really important to learn those things. So I think if you have that as an option, that's great. Otherwise, you know, use your preclinical and into an IDE is also a very good way to go.
Got it. Yeah, it seems like the landscape has changed, you know, pretty drastically. I mean, that always, as you mentioned, that always used to be the default approach, right? Start in Europe, get a CE mark. It's much easier to you know, kickstart your first in human clinicals, but you know, with the change, the MDR, you know, regulations, especially, you know, I think with COVID headwinds as well, and potential travel restrictions and logistical issues, it seems like at least I'm hearing a lot more startups entertain first in human work here in the US, you know, and maybe it's a little bit more costly, but the time efficiencies, you know, are there for that type of work. I mean, is that what you're seeing? Would you tend to agree, or like what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. That change has kind of occurred. And like I was saying, the RASD center of the regulatory world really is the FDA. Mm-hmm. You know, that's who's got really the most experience. And so, you know, you can be strategic about that. I think, you know, working with the FDA in that sense really made sense. But then, you know, if you do have options, you know, I think Medtronic went to India first with Hugo and some things like this, and maybe CMR stayed out in Europe for a while. And I don't know if they'll go for FDA, but, you know, I think it really is a number. It can depend on the company and where your locus is, but I do think FDA IDE is a good approach for these types of systems now. And we just had a very nice connection to be able to do that down in Paraguay. So that worked out well for us, and we were able to learn a lot there.
Got it. Yeah, that's definitely interesting. And your approach with pursuing the de novo pathway, and then with other devices for expanded indications or other applications, sort of, you know, fast following with the 510K then pathway once that de novo is established. That I mean, that sounds brilliant. I mean, that sounds like, I'm not sure if there was a, you know, there is a, you know, if that was, you know, relatively straightforward from the get-go, but I love the approach and sort of the savvy there in trying to optimize around kind of the entire sort of portfolio or platform
on. You know what? I think with robotics, you're never really quite done. You know, I think it took Intuitive, you know, 10 or 15 years to get a vessel sealer or advanced energy and staplers type things, you know, and we're going to need to add instrumentation. And then again, we got this, you know, this family of robots. We kind of shrink the robots down and change the degrees of freedom and use different instruments is what we're planning and working on. And so this seemed to make a lot of sense, you know, to do this stage-wise type of approach versus trying to get a general robot through everything and every indication, I think is a far different undertaking.
Yeah, I guess what I'm hearing from you is just you've got like that type of technology, like a platform type of play.
Yes.
Like thinking not just about like the near term, like 3 to 5 year kind of reg approach, but thinking about all of those follow-up applications would be, is wise, you know what I mean? And what are the potential efficiencies? Spending a little bit, maybe more time on a de novo up front, but if there's a lot of time savings on the back end with kind of that 510K approach, that could make a lot of sense. John, I want to leave a little bit of time for the rapid fire round of questions here at the end. But thinking about virtual incision and the next maybe, you know, 1 to 2 years, you know, what are you most excited about? And then alternatively, you know, what tends to keep you up at night?
Yeah, you know, as a product person, I'm really excited about the gear. I actually think Mirror is just a beautiful system. But then going back to our mission, you know, it'll be incredible to see Mirror used in all sorts of OR settings. You know, like I say, from the community hospital to the ASC and to potentially outside the US as well. So I think that's really exciting to see that journey. And then, you know, on the things that keep you up at night, you know, we're currently going through a pretty intense period of clinical and regulatory milestones. So that focus on our patients and on the clinical teams and on the study endpoints and the learnings, you know, is key. So we're excited about where we are, and we just got to keep making progress with our different parties that we're working with here.
Yeah, and for those listening, we mentioned the website earlier, but is that the place that you probably direct the audience to that's listening and wants to learn a little bit more about the company, is virtualincision.com?
I think that's right, Scott. Yep.
Okay, yeah. So if you're listening and don't get a chance to get to the show notes for this interview, go to virtualincision.com. It's just like it sounds, virtualincision.com. And then if you do make it to the show notes, we'll have a full recap of the interview here with John, with kind of key highlights of the interview, as well as links to the company, as well as John's LinkedIn profile as well. Hey everyone, it's Scott, and I wanted to briefly interrupt this interview to tell you a little bit more about Big Sky Biomedical, a medtech incubator that I co-founded earlier this year with a team of serial entrepreneurs and proven operators that all have a stellar track record of success. One of our first companies, Fastwave Medical, closed on an investment plus milestone-based acquisition agreement within 6 months of forming the entity. I've been told that breaks some type of record within the medtech space, which is pretty cool. We're actively working on several other portfolio companies, one of which is Crossfire Medical, that's focused on intravenous interventional therapies and has attracted its own share of attention. This accelerator incubator model is definitely not a new concept, but most don't work for a variety of reasons. So here's how we're doing it differently at Big Sky. First, our entire team has deep domain expertise in the interventional arena. This is the only sandbox we play in, which allows for some pretty intense focus. Second, through our partnership with Switchback Medical, we're able to scale up our development efforts incredibly fast, which often shaves 6 to 12 months off a traditional R&D PDP. Third, our team can leverage capital to kickstart projects quickly and efficiently. Going from 0 to 1 is definitely within our wheelhouse. If you're interested in learning more or potentially partnering with us, check out MedsiderRadio.com/Big Sky. Again, that's MedsiderRadio.com/Big Sky. Okay, let's get back to the rest of the conversation.
So with that said, let's spend a little bit of time with this rapid fire round of questions. Yeah. It's how I typically like to kind of wrap up the conversations. The questions are rapid fire in nature, but if you want to expand upon the your answers, that's totally fine. So yeah. First one I've got for you, John, is since starting Virtual Incision, or like kind of, you know, leading the company back in the, you know, 2011, 2012 timeframe, what's the most unexpected thing that you've learned?
Yeah, you know, after about 10 years now, I'm shocked that we continue to be completely unique. I think we've got 200 patents and patent applications around this mini robot, self-contained mini robot approach. But, you know, the competitive landscape has focused on either Me Too mainframe robots or Me Too cable-driven snake robots. And I think ours still stands out. So, That's been, you know, really quite a surprise.
yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't have expected that to be your answer, but yeah. definitely seems like you're onto something, especially with the procedural trends, right? Moving from, you know, inside a hospital in several different, like, you know, categories or therapeutic areas, you know, so many procedures are moving outside of the hospital into the ASC or the office-based lab. You know, it seems like you're positioned pretty well for that.
Yeah, what's shocking there is you just take orthopedics. I think about 30% of surgeries are done at the ASC, but general surgery is right there with it. About 30% of cases are done in the ASC. So, you know, I think a small, easy to use, you know, available system here for those types of settings could be really exciting.
Yeah, and maybe any would-be competitor looks at your IP portfolio and it just scares them off. You know what I mean? I mean, 200 patents. That's a lot. That's a moat. That's what I like to call a moat. You know? So yeah. That's good work to you and the team creating that for sure. So next question, John. If we were having this conversation in a maybe in an in-person conference, you had a room full of, you know, 200 med tech or healthcare entrepreneurs. What's the one key thing that you'd want everyone to really take home?
Yeah, you know what? I'd say spend the vast majority of your time on the clinical solution. Mm-hmm. Just really trying to solve the toughest challenges first. And, you know, if there was another thing, I'd say you have to realize you're pretty much always going to be fundraising. So recognize that's a big part of it. And then just try to work with people you like. If you can get to that position, because you're going to be in this a long time and you've got to be aligned around your goals to the company and that kind of support. So there might be a couple of little things I'd want to highlight.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned more than one, you know, especially the last one, you know, making sure that you're working with the team that you, you know, you can go have beers with, you know, outside of the work setting. Yeah. And, you know, that's good. And, you know, what's interesting about your comment about fundraising, I run into every now and then, you know, startup founders that they just don't want to fundraise, right? They don't like it. It's too hard, et cetera. And, you know, I always used to have the opinion of like, yeah, I get that, but I've kind of come full circle and it's like, if you don't embrace that, that aspect, I mean, it's just going to be such a tough slog. You know what I mean? And your comment around just kind of know that it's part of the game. You know, it's just part of the deal. You always be fundraising. I'm glad you mentioned that, especially with your experience.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's that fundraising is your lifeblood. It's your oxygen, right? And then I mentioned earlier, if you really have this capital efficiency mindset, as well. I mean, those things will help you get through most of the different ups and downs that you just continuously go through as an entrepreneur. Yeah.
That's good stuff. Good stuff. All right. Third question. Three out of the four here. We're almost at the end here. Is there a book or educational resource that you've recommended the most over the past few years?
Yeah. You know, with mRNA coming to the fore, obviously with the vaccines and all that, I've recommended Kraken Creation a whole bunch of times. And I even reread The Gene, which is, I think, just a beautiful written history. So I'm going back to my life sciences and bio days on that one. But then I think AI Superpowers is fantastic by Kai-Fu Lee. Gives you a great grounding on what's happening in the AI world. And then anything Michael Lewis or cycling books by Phil Guymon, I'm all up for it. So there's a few ideas for you.
Yeah, those are good. Those are ones that haven't come up in a lot of the other discussions. But going back to the first one you mentioned, Kraken Creation. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's great. It's by Jennifer Doudna, who, you know, the Cal prof who's really pioneered the CRISPR techniques, you know, building on the shoulders of giants, really.
Okay.
And it's just a great story, and it shows you how things like CRISPR techniques really work, and then where it's kind of going. So
cool.
There you go.
That's good stuff. All right. Last question for you, John, is thinking back to maybe your mid to late 20s or that point in your professional career. Is there one thing that you would do differently, whether it be, you know, career related or just, you know, other roles that you took on, you know, what would, is there one or two things that stand out?
Yeah, you know, I got no regrets, as it's been great fun. You know, really, especially the global experiences, and then, you know, just deep tech products from jet engines to glass cockpits to mass spectrometers to reagents to different devices and robots. That's been awesome. But if there was one thought, maybe I would have gotten to venture earlier rather than doing several stints in private equity, because I think at heart I'm more of an entrepreneur, and I love building companies, you know, versus grinding on EBITDA and debt and dividend recaps and things like this. So if that might be my only orientation is to go to venture kind of company building earlier.
Yeah, I hear that so often, and almost like it's a bit cliche, right? That often, you know, so many people would say, I wish I would have started earlier in my career. But I mean, that's been the case with me, you know what I mean? I spent the majority of the first 3/4 of my time in big strategics, you know, and always had a bit of an entrepreneurial itch or bend. I was always working on side projects.
Yeah.
And, you know, in retrospect, over the past, you know, key learnings for me personally over the past 5 to 6 years, it's like, oh man, I wish I would have made the leap, you know, sooner, you know what I mean? And I've heard so many people, you know, echo the same sentiment.
Yeah, it takes a lot of staying power, though, doesn't it? So yeah. It's nice if you have had some corporate or PE experiences, you know, because you don't make a lot of money early on, for sure. And you got to have a lot of staying power when it comes to startups. So maybe there's some good and bad that goes with all that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, definitely don't regret the experiences, for sure. But maybe would have left a little bit sooner than I did. But with that said, this has been a fun conversation. John, anything else that you want to share with the audience, other than, you know, head on over to Virtual Incision if you're want to learn a little bit more about the company. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I appreciate you being interested in Virtual Incision. It's nice and fun to kind of share our story a little bit. We've had our heads down fairly stealthy for quite some time, but, you know, we do our talking in the clinic, so to speak. And, you know, this is our time now, where we've got so many important milestones ahead of us. So I really appreciate you spending some time with me.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to you know, spend about an hour helping teach and coach up, you know, the would be entrepreneurs that listen and read the MedCyber content. So with that said, again, everyone, if you're listening and want to learn a little bit more, or if you want to just, you know, reread this conversation, right, in a more summarized sort of fashion, head on over to MedCider.com and just do a search for virtual incision or John Murphy, and you can find the recap there. And then again, if you're not signed up for our email newsletter, definitely do that while you're on the website. We won't spam you. We won't sell your email address. The only time you'll hear from us is when a new interview goes live. So definitely sign up for the email newsletter. So, with that said, John, I'll have you hold on, but, for everyone listening that's made it this far, thanks for your attention as always. And until the next episode of MedCider, take care.